Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1324.EZ0808, certificate number 33725, track 61.
One of the great Dylan albums.
Blood on track 61. Have you ever recorded an album with a track 61?
No.
How close did you get?
I got up to track 10.
Is there any record with that? What about that They Might Be Giants record that has all the little mini songs?
Oh,
Pass the Milk, Please.
Right.
Is that track 61?
Fingertips.
Fingertips. Aren't you the guy that hit me in the eye? I wonder how many of those we could just sing if we tried to think of all of them instead of talking about the actual track
come
61.
Come on.
And Wreck
come
My
on.
Car. And there's, what's that blue thing doing here?
Track 61 is a mysterious.
I knew it was mysterious. You know why?
Why?
Because it sounds like Area 51.
It does.
It's like 10 more mysterious than Area 51.
Although it's not as mysterious as Area 51.
Damn it.
You can actually see Track 61 without too much trouble. You don't have to climb up to a peak.
Is that how you saw Area 51?
Yeah,
you climbed up to a peak?
No, I saw Area 51 when they tried to dissect me when I originally arrived on Earth. But then I adopted a...
It's like your Ellis Island. Do you go back there with your family? Here it is, guys. This is how I came to this great land.
I adopted the shape and form of an Air Force major and killed everyone in the room and then took the elevator to the surface.
And then you chose... A third form, which is this.
Well, which is this.
You were briefly an Air Force major, but just for a few minutes.
No, then after I got to the surface, I spread my black wings and flew to Seattle where I assumed my final form.
Your final. This isn't even his final form. Well, that's great. The secret origin.
Yeah, secret origin of at least my time on Earth. You don't know where I came from or what I really am.
But even with all that access, have you ever been to Track 61?
No, although I've seen Track 61. Track 61 is visible as you leave Grand Central Station on any train headed out, particularly trains on the left-hand side.
You'd be heading, what, north,
you'd
right?
be headed north out of Grand Central.
Yeah.
Track 61 is a train station under the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. So you can picture the Waldorf Astoria there on Park Avenue just... north of Grand Central.
It's like in the 40s, it's 50th maybe?
It is on 49th.
49th,
yeah, so, okay. So just there, between Park and Lex.
This is the kind of thing where people who live in New York and LA think that everyone should understand all their local references.
Right. And here we are just rambling on, and there are many, many people listening to the show who have never been to New York. And in fact, futurelings may think of New York as just a giant crater in the middle of what is the Hudson River to them, like, or maybe it's the Splork River.
Like the Ground Zero Monument is actually in the middle of a much larger Ground Zero Monument. It's like just concentric Ground Zeros now.
There's just the top of the Empire State Building just sticking out of the water. They're sticking out of a giant bay.
You know, we have a lot of local references on this show, but it's to Seattle, a city that we know no one actually understands or can visualize.
Well, they think of Seattle as an archipelago of small, weird islands filled with basically sentient fleece.
I've seen a map of a, you know, projected Seattle when, if the polar ice caps were to completely melt. Have you seen this map?
I have.
Are you on dry land?
I am.
Because this is pretty high.
It is. I possess the map, in fact. And, you know, when I bought this house, I made certain that it would survive any superheated lahar from any of our local volcanoes.
I can just see you out with a hammer and some plywood making those modifications that would make your house lahar proof.
Actually, I think this house might be pretty close to waterfront property in the event of a catastrophe.
Yeah, I'm within a couple streets of the water line. I think the ridge I'm on will become a nice little peninsula extending south.
Won't that be nice?
It'll be great.
Just a short walk down to the beach. Where you see the roofs of your neighbors' houses descend into the murky depths.
Yeah, I wonder how much of that kind of spelunking there will be. It'll happen gradually.
So much. Are you kidding me? That's where I would spend all my time.
But it won't be like a deluge.
Right.
You know, every year it'll just be a few more houses.
The Waldorf Astoria, which is sort of the...
There's no way to get back when there's two steps removed. That's what I've learned. You can't...
You just have
you
to
You can't
jump.
Segue back when it's two segues.
No, you have to leap back, a giant leap. The hotel, which is the sort of the premier hotel of New York City for many, many decades.
You said it in a kind of a French way.
Premier.
Le premier hotel.
The premier hotel.
It was two premier hotels, right? Do you know the story?
Tell me the Waldorf Astoria two hotels story.
I guess the Astor family, the descendants of John Jacob Astor, the fur guy, they were fighting and... some wealthy Astor decides to build a giant hotel, I think at the time on Fifth, right next to his aunt's mansion, just to piss her off, I think. She moves out, and some other brother builds another hotel next door. So there's two hotels right there, and there was the Waldorf and the Astoria. They did not hyphenate until a little connection was built, I don't know, very early 20th century, maybe. Peacock Alley was literally the hyphen that connected the Waldorf and the Astoria.
That is such a lovely story of
family hatred.
Of family hatred. The Waldorf Astoria is actually built, they secured the air rights over the New York Central Railway. It's built sort of in the atmosphere above the tracks, and they don't actually own the land. They're leasing the location of the Waldorf Astoria from the train.
Which some railroad still owns. Their footprint?
Yeah, the railroad, because the entirety of the sub-basement of the Astoria or the Waldorf Astoria is train tracks. I mean, that's the enormous number of tracks that lead into Grand Central all are right underneath the hotel, which makes Track 61 possible.
Track 61 is in the bowels of the Waldorf Astoria.
It is. It is a train station that serves only the Waldorf Astoria.
Really?
And it was built during the tenure of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt as a way of masking his polio.
Oh, because if he pulled up to the hotel in any other way, it would be clear that he's having to
right, he would
get into his wheelchair or...
It was a public performance arriving at the hotel, and he, being a New Yorker, traveled often from Washington, D.C. to New York and stayed at the Waldorf Astoria, and so had this, the federal government commissioned it being built, but did not pay for it. It was paid for by the railroad so that he could access the hotel, you know, without, as you say, appearing on the streets in a wheelchair.
This is the kind of thing where if if President Trump wanted some business to pay for some, this no doubt super expensive bit of infrastructure just for his ego, you know? Can you imagine like President Trump demanding a roof be put on something so no one could see his hair from above or something?
Well, concealing his polio wasn't just, I don't think, just an ego move. I think it really, they were afraid that it would throw into question his capability as a leader of the free world. The idea then being that a disability cast a shadow on all your other abilities.
The craziness of Able, like this is the first train station that ableism built,
that's
I assume.
Right. Well, maybe not. I haven't like investigated the whole record of train stations built to mask various disabilities.
You have a few systems left to look at. Haven't done Cairo, haven't done Bratislava. And this was before the war when it was, I mean, during the war, it would be like deeply unpatriotic to reveal the president's condition, right? It would be bad for the effort against the forces of evil.
Well, you know, this was an era when there was a considerable noblesse oblige and the
afforded to political leaders.
Yeah, and the Fourth Estate, the news media generally allowed, famously, Kennedy to have affairs and FDR to have polio.
This went on shockingly late. Do you remember how shocked everybody was when the Miami Herald actually staked out Gary Hart in 1988? You know, this is some guy who'd apparently been womanizing for years and made the mistake of telling the Washington Post, follow me around, see what happens.
Yeah.
So the Miami Herald, who actually did have had received a tip and actually did have somebody staked outside his place in Georgetown, everyone was shocked that they actually reported that young women were coming in and out.
It felt like a breach of some kind of agreed upon etiquette.
As late as 88, this was not how we did things. There was a game and it was played like this, which to me, I feel like, you know, one response to that is to be like, yeah, why can't we go back to that kind of decorum? And to me, honestly, it always seemed a little crooked that everybody was just winking at who was coming in and out of Kennedy or LBJ's hotel room.
Oh, it's enormously crooked. But how do you want your, where do you want your president to be a crook? I mean, if you can pick a way.
I mean, the theory, so this doesn't hold so much, I feel, for FDR having a secret train. You know, the president who's lying to you about a secret train, what else could he be lying to you about? But right. I feel like that does hold with
with having multiple affairs.
The president who's having serial girls. Affairs yeah. And his wife has been separated from him on and off because he's so awful. What could that possibly have to do with leadership or integrity?
It's true, but I would take a president having affairs over one who's building like border walls and,
sure.
and prisoner encampments.
That's not often a choice you get.
It's not a choice. Well, it is kind of. In recent years, at least.
I guess it depends on what the ballot looks like. But there's not like the party of philandering nominates whoever,
right.
Bill Clinton, and the party of border walls nominates. I mean, in theory, you could have a president both philandering and doing border walls, which is probably the case right now. And you could have a president doing neither, which has been the case for much of American history.
Well, for at least some of it. You get the sense that Obama and George Walker Bush were both happily
extremely
and faithfully
faithful
married.
To their wives. Yeah. Although now I think one is having an affair with the other's wife.
Oh, yeah. That candy passing. What's that all about?
I think Bush was delighted to become a bipartisan meme when he was spotted getting Michelle a cough drop or something. And now it's his trademark move.
He's trying to rehabilitate himself as a charming Muppet.
I paint my dog now and I give Michelle candy across party lines. I remind you.
Yeah. Although I continue to support Brett Kavanaugh.
It's kind of like I was watching the second candy pass, and it really does seem like somebody who's very aware that this maybe this will go viral.
Yeah.
He's now the thirstiest ex-president.
He pulls the candy out and surveys it in the light for a
hey,
second.
Hey, like, millennials.
Look at this.
What's the tea about this candy?
The thing about the choo-choo trains.
Again, you just got to jump back.
Kapow.
It's at least three steps removed.
I love that you're getting more engaged in sidebars, and I think it's because you're drinking a Diet Dr. Pepper a little bit into the afternoon.
I'm putting the pep back in Dr. Pepper right now. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too? Do you want to sip?
I am a freaking pepper. Are you kidding me? I've been a pepper since the TV commercials where the guy from American Werewolf in London did that exciting dance.
Wait, that's the same guy from American Werewolf in London?
The guy from the Dr. Pepper commercials of the
I'm
of the
a pepper,
early,
he's a pepper, she's a pepper.
Was
a
cast pepper. In American Werewolf in London from the
on
TV
the
commercial.
Of the commercial?
Yeah, it was like, that guy. Who's, get that guy.
Usually it's the other way around. Like once you're a spokesperson, it kills your career because everyone will look at you and be like, why is the Dos Equis guy,
right.
the concierge? Like it happened to Flo was one of the receptionists on Mad Men, the Flo from Progressive.
Oh,
and,
no, really?
Yeah, she was like a real actress. She was had a recurring part on Mad Men. And then as soon as she became Flo, she's done.
Right.
Luckily, she's a progressive billionaire, so she doesn't need AMC money anymore.
Like that guy from the Can You Hear Me Now Verizon ads who...
That guy just has a career being... speaking of... Apparently. Thirsty guys trying to recapture their viral love. Can you hear me now, guy?
Apparently he hated working for Verizon. I guess I know somebody who knows him. I've heard all these private stories about him. I don't know why.
Formerly private stories.
You remember Monica from Friends made her debut in the Bruce Springsteen music video.
Sure, you can't start a fire without a spark.
That's right.
It's the Dancing in the Dark video.
And, you know, she's very much my type in that video, but somehow...
Didn't you make fun of me for liking Monica because you're a Rachel?
I'm definitely a Rachel, but Monica in the Dancing in the Dark video, I remember cartoon hearts floating around my head. But by the time she made it to Friends,
black Irish thing with the blue eyes, like if Alec Baldwin was a beautiful woman.
Well, she does that thing where she's like, "Who, me?" I mean, I bought it the first time I saw it. I was like, "Wow, this is amazing."
She was going to be picked.
Beautiful girl from the crowd, and then later on, I was disappointed to find that the whole thing was staged.
Is it? Do I count as a Pepper? I'm actually going to go one step back, which will help you get back to
you
to
have
trains.
A diet, Dr. Pepper, which yeah, I feel like
that's my question. Am I a Pepper?
It takes about half the pepper out of you. I think
I'm a half pepper,
but it is giving like you pep.
I'm like those little Costco miniature peppers.
I think people will, listening to the shows, will be able to identify the ones where you were just tired and sat there just going, mm-hmm.
Peek behind the curtain. We record your show, your Thursday show, after the Tuesday show. So if you're a futureling listening to these in alphabetical order on a ruined earth, you have not noticed this.
Right.
But in our era, we alternated and we always do John's show second.
Right.
Which means that I'm bored. I just want to go home at this point.
Yeah, checking his phone through the whole thing while I'm like, so
track 61. Hey, look at this from the Bush funeral.
Yeah.
Note. So how far did you get on track 61? It was not built with federal money, but the railroad had to shell out. Must have been expensive. It's just a trunk line for one person.
Well, this happens a lot. You know, if you stay in the presidential suite at the Waldorf Astoria, it is thousands of dollars a night, $8,000 a night or something like that. But wow, that is not what they charge the United States government when the president stays there.
More or less.
They charge him considerably less because it's a lost leader for them. The president staying there generates tremendous business
and is
for
this,
the hotel.
Like, do they feel like if they actually charge market value, he'd be like, whatever, I'm going to the Westin?
Well, it's a bad optic, right? To charge the American people, although we're happily paying.
Yeah, I'm sure the Secret Service costs for the visit would be 30 times the accommodations.
Yeah, but they give it to him at the presidential discount because I think they also, I mean, they take over three floors of the hotel or something.
Do they toss in like room service?
Boy.
Or what about minibar? Like if the president's checking out there, like, well, you jiggled the thing of the little Pringles thing. Mm-hmm. That's $9.
You opened the fridge, so.
You looked at the Jim Beam.
Actually, what happens at the Waldorf Astoria stays at the Waldorf Astoria. The Secret Service doesn't want you to know whether the president gets into the minibar or not, right? For kind of obvious reasons. They don't want housekeeping to be corrupted by the RSU or whatever, the North Korean Secret Service.
Probably the RSU.
Yeah.
Is that a thing?
The RSU, isn't that the evolution of the KGB? Yeah, it's not the RSU, it's the FSB.
I defer to you on all Soviet related acronyms.
After the dissolution of the Soviet Union, it became the Russian Federal Security Service, but because it's in Russian, it's FSB. And it's not even really an F, it's like a splurg.
Think how iconic KGB was. Like, you could say it in a movie and everyone would immediately have a million pictures. And, you know, today, when I'm sure the Russian espionage threat is probably, you know, just as big a part of geopolitics, I have no idea what the FSB was. Like, I assumed the FSB would be like some nice, it's a New Deal acronym or it's sure, some home loan federal thing.
I work for the FSB, the Federal Security Bank.
If you said you worked for the FSB, I'd be like, oh, nice, government job.
Yeah.
Good pension, I bet.
Well, you know, I'm totally into this spy stuff and I'm like, RSU, FSB, I don't know, man.
RSVP.
Whatever.
Alphabet soup, am I right?
But they don't want, the Secret Service doesn't want you to know. And they don't want you to know a lot of things, including how presidents travel these days. But in FDR's
for security reasons
and security reasons at a lot of different levels.
There's fake motorcade sometimes, right? Like there's a second limousine. Who knows which one the guy's in?
Every motorcade has fake limousines in it. And also when the president's helicopter flies, when Marine One is in the air, they also have decoy helicopters.
And there's often a second fake Melania as well.
There's a Melania that's
a lot of people
that's
don't know
wearing a sweatshirt that says like, I don't give a fuck about you. but they can't do like a fake Air Force One because that would be pretty ridiculous to have multiple 747s flying at the same time. But they
what
do
if the
do
second one was like an Airbus? So it was like kind of cheaper Or it was like an Embraer.
What
if it's smaller, but it's much closer to you? Like they fly a much smaller plane, very low. And so no one can tell if it's real Air Force One or not.
You don't know which side of Air Force One the terrorist with a shoulder launched like HARM missile or whatever. They don't know where he's standing. So they can't.
They can't cater to his.
And I'm going to presume it's a he. I'm going to use the male pronoun there.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm going to say he is out there with a missile because I don't know.
Hashtag not all terrorists.
I have not yet heard of a transgender Muslim terrorist.
Or a female one. They don't have to be trans.
Yeah. I think even less likely.
Well, you know why? Because assumptions like yours. That's what's key. It's a glass ceiling.
It's true.
It's true.
I don't want to keep
female terrorists.
I don't want to keep any women who are trying to shoot down Air Force One. I don't want to like keep them under some kind of weird patriarchal thumb. But also we'd better stop talking about this because this is precisely the kind of speculation that might attract the attention.
How long do you have to wonder about your assassination plans on a podcast before you get a phone call?
Right. And the thing is
we're going to find out.
Futurelings may have an organization called the RSU.
And they're like, he mentioned us. Like click. Did you hear a little click sound? There's clearly no female Islamist terrorists because if you're a woman, there is no way you want to hang out with 72 virgin men. It's just not an incentive.
Not an incentive.
You could just go to an anime convention or something, I guess.
True.
You don't need to blow anything up.
Although there have been innumerable female
suicide bombers.
So I wonder what they're being promised.
Hmm.
You know what? You go back to being a virgin and you get to be one of 72.
I don't think that's much of an angle. No. It would probably be more like, you go to the separate heaven where they leave you alone.
Oh, separate heaven. Separate heaven where you can drive and
right.
And no one is looking at you.
So they don't, the president's travel plans never get out in advance.
But in FDR's day, of course, that wasn't as possible. And he traveled by train, as many, many U.S. presidents did.
Sure.
From the very beginning.
That was the main way of campaigning for over 100 years.
It was. FDR had though, a private train car built for him, what was known as rail car, or U.S. car number one.
Oh, like in Wild Wild West.
Yes, very similar to the one in Wild Wild West.
It's probably based on this.
It had, it was armor-plated. And
oh, really? For what? People on the siding with shotguns?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, even the floor was armor plated. So they anticipated the possibility of there being a bomb placed under the tracks. Mm-hmm. And he used it extensively, both to go between Washington and New York and down to Miami, where he vacationed. And it was his sort of office away from home. I mean, he also had a presidential yacht.
Was it oval shaped?
It was
the car, because you go through a tunnel and then you just lose the sides.
Right.
You can't have an Oval Office on a train.
It was not lozenge shaped, but it was and remains the heaviest rail car ever built in the United States.
Just because of all the metal.
It's fantastic. But it had a wonderful bedroom and meeting room and it continued to be used. It was used by Truman very successfully during his presidentiality. He traveled all around the country. And in fact, the
word presidency having not yet been coined.
Presidentiality.
We said back at the time.
That famous picture where he's holding up the newspaper like Dewey defeats Truman.
Truman wins presidentiality.
that was taken on the back balcony of this.
Yeah, rip. Yeah. You can see he's on a train.
And that train, I guess Eisenhower was the president to retire that train. I think the last trip was Mamie Eisenhower rode it.
And Eisenhower probably the first to have a 747, right?
No 747 at that point. In fact, Kennedy.
Oh, Kennedy's the first?
Kennedy still was traveling in a 707. I think the first 747.
Oh, I thought the 747. I thought Kennedy's Air Force One that's on display here in Seattle is a 747.
No, the 747 didn't debut until 1968.
Well, your math checks out then.
So there would not have been, I think probably Nixon.
I guess it's true. I've been on that JFK Air Force One and it's not big.
No, it's quite a bit smaller.
It's tiny. Eisenhower was the first president to use the Air Force One call sign, though.
Right.
It just wasn't on the dedicated jet we were imagining today.
And FDR's train car, US-1, was called POTUS.
Really?
In its time. I always thought that was a modern coinage.
I feel like, yeah, it feels very post-Sorkin to me.
But they say POTUS, even back then.
Maybe they spelled it out. POTUS.
Yeah.
RSU.
Here he comes, POTUS. Everyone, on guard. But Roosevelt, as part of his masking of his polio, had a limousine and a special car built where the limousine could drive on and off the rail car. So he could get in the car on the train and it would drive out through a special wide door.
The car would drive into the train. This is like Knight Rider or something.
The car would drive into the train. Well, it gets better because when they built Track 61, they built it so that the car could drive off the train onto the platform and into a special elevator that was big enough to hold his Packard limousine.
And it takes him up to the suite?
So there are two exits from Track 61. One of them into the lobby of the Waldorf Astoria, where he did one time actually drive the car.
Do you think he's the only president ever to drive through the lobby of the Waldorf Astoria?
Maybe not, because...
Because Trump did it yesterday.
Because this track continued to be used and continues to be used, although off record.
Oh, it's still there.
It's still there. And there's actually, the elevator will take you up to a sort of a brass door that's right on 49th Street between Park and Lexington. And it has an address, 101-121, on the door. And you can still get down to Track 61 through this entrance.
Do you have to say, is it like a speakeasy? Or do you have to be like Swordfish and they let you down?
I think one day a year, the runes appear if you speak in Elvish to it. Or no, you'd have to speak in Dwarvish to it because it was built by dwarves.
You have to look for the thrush breaking the shell or whatever.
So it's unclear, or rather it is unspoken, whether or not presidents continue to use it. Although they have... So during the sort of 9/11 era, when George Bush went to New York to lobby for the invasion of Iraq.
And to pose with rubble and throw pitches at Yankee games.
No, it came later. He did that like immediately. That was his whole...
you're talking about later UN kind of...
Yeah, when he went to the UN and Colin Powell held up a baggie of cocaine and said that it was... weapons of mass destruction.
Really? He held up a bag of cocaine?
Yeah.
Why did we believe that guy?
He took it from...
I was snorting this stuff, and I realized, I became aware, Mandrake, in the middle of the physical act of love, that there were WMDs in Iraq.
I think it was a mistake. He had a baggie of anthrax, but George Bush had a baggie of coke, and they got mixed up in their gym bags. But during that period, they actually had a locomotive and a presidential car idling under the Waldorf Astoria, so that they didn't turn the motor off, waiting there in case he needed to make a rapid escape.
Is it still like an old-timey steam locomotive?
No, it's a diesel locomotive, but...
Oh, it's diesel. It's not like an electric New York subway car.
No, they made it diesel so that in the event of some kind of electromagnetic pulse or otherwise a disabling of the subway system...
Which happens every day in Manhattan.
They could continue to haul ass through town in this diesel locomotive.
Oh, wow.
And
that's the most exciting presidential thing you could do, probably.
Can you imagine?
Is escape a burning city in your own private underground diesel train.
Well, this will infuriate New Yorkers, but... The claim is that from the Waldorf Astoria to JFK, that transit can be made in 7 minutes in this presidential train.
Wow.
They route all other subways to the side, and he gets in the express and they gun it.
When I'm president, I'm going to be like, I prefer Newark.
Yeah, right.
I like Newark.
Take me out of LaGuardia. Although, no, please do not ever take me out of LaGuardia again. I sat on that tarmac one time for 5 hours waiting to fly.
Is LaGuardia a little closer, though?
It's much closer.
So why go all the way out to JFK?
Well, LaGuardia is not a secure airport. And in fact, when the president visits New York, Air Force One parks over in New Jersey somewhere. And now that Trump... There was a lot of fear when Trump first took office that, in fact, he said he didn't want to live in the White House. He wanted to continue to live in Trump Tower.
Was that the main source of fear, was where he was, what would be his residence?
that
was the main thing that was worrying everyone?
That first few
Where's
weeks.
Where's he going to live?
The thing is, what worries the Secret Service is different from what worries you and me.
That's correct.
So they were trying to figure out, like, and I think eventually they said, you cannot live at Trump Tower.
Yeah, I think if he had his druthers... although he's not the kind of person who has druthers. But if he did, he would probably, he would prefer to be on Manhattan.
He'd be eating Big Macs right now in his Trump Tower. And
well done steaks with ketchup on them.
Yeah. And there were all these problems. Like the nearest place you can land a helicopter is up in Grand Union Square or whatever, up there several or a couple of blocks at least from Trump Tower. And then really the closest place you can land a couple of helicopters is up in Central Park. Hmm. So getting him out of New York was going to be very complicated.
In the case of some kind of John Carpenter scenario. Right.
Up until the Obama administration, every U.S. president from the construction of the Waldorf Astoria to the present, or to 2015, every president stayed in the presidential suite at the Waldorf Astoria, including Obama early on in his presidency. But then the hotel was purchased by the Chinese. And there was some Secret Service fear that the Chinese government would have infiltrated the hotel and would be using...
bugged like the 80s era embassy in Moscow?
That's right. They got in there and were going to use cyber hacking on the president. And so he was the last president to stay at the Waldorf.
Because now the minibar has Chinese surveillance.
Yeah, it's got...
He did touch the Pringles. He touched the peanut M&Ms too.
He owes us $9. So I think, given that George Bush had that escape plan in place and that locomotive idling on Track 61, I think there is quite a bit of suspicion that it remains an active stop, not only for presidents, but perhaps for the wealthy few.
Anybody with the money, I guess, right?
It used to be very popular to have a private train car. And in fact, when I was a kid... Yes.
It was popular when you were a kid to have a private train car.
Well, no, but I have ridden in a private train car.
Whose?
Many times. My father in the 1970s was the chief counsel of the Alaska Railroad, which at the time was a federally owned railroad, but not connected to the federal system. The Alaska Railroad was run by the Department of Transportation. And my dad was the chief legal officer. And the Alaska Railroad had a private train car that dated to this era. It had bedrooms and a big living room and a balcony on the back. And they would connect it to a train if an executive, basically the president of the railroad or my dad, wanted to go somewhere along the railroad. So he would have it, I mean, this is a different time, but he would have this car brought up and connected to the train, and we would go on official business up to Fairbanks or whatever, and it would be my dad, me, and my sister in this.
Did it secretly pull up underground under the Fairbanks Federal Building?
No, there are no undergrounds in Alaska.
Because it's frozen. It's permafrost. It's not beautiful hoarfrost.
It's a wonderful experience, and this thing was kitted out in top 1940s technology, which then seemed pretty amazing. Black and white TV and a phone that went ring-a-ding-a-ding.
So I know that there are lots of world transit systems that have disused trains and train platforms like this, right? In London, I know, if you ever watch a movie or an episode of Sherlock or whatever that's set in London, if there's ever a tube station, it's almost certainly Aldwych Station, which was, I think, shut down in the early 20th century. And since then, well, during the war, it was an air raid shelter, and they all the art galleries would put their art there during the Blitz. And today, it's just where, you know, V for Vendetta shoots its train scenes because it's tailor-made for a film crew without shutting anything down.
It's kind of inevitable when you're building a mass transit system that over time, certain stations will become disused. And I think in the popular imagination, it's because those stations have low ridership. But in most cases, it's actually, like in New York, there are a dozen or more subway stops that are abandoned.
They're still there? They never got repurposed? They're
still there. But the reason isn't that they have low ridership. It is that as they expand other stations, they're deemed just too proximate.
Right.
So they don't want the train stopping every 150 feet. And as, you know, as Broadway and Lafayette grows, they decide that Canal Street doesn't need to be there. And depending on when they close those stations, some of them can be incredible time capsules.
I do want to say that when we say low ridership, we should say low ridership. Isn't that better?
Get a little higher.
Yeah, that's happened to many London stations, I think. You know, once Holborn opens, you don't need Aldwych or whatever. It's, you know, it's right there.
Yeah. But there are quite a few instances. I mean, the abandoned railway station is a whole version of train spotting, in particular in England. In the 1960s, the English went through a train modernization program that was sort of pushed by a single guy, by a man named Beeching, who put forward this plan to decommission an enormous portion of the British rail system. The British rail system underwent this like spasm of growth before World War I. They just got so excited about trains. They just put trains everywhere. And in fact, what's crazy is right before the advent of the railroad, the British had built canals everywhere. There used to be an interlocking canal system that would allow you to take a boat from Manchester all the way down to
I've walked by that canal in Manchester. So you're saying like 10 years later, this was all obsolete once steam engines?
Well, it's like the Erie Canal. The Erie Canal, they spent enormous resources building this, and it was going to connect Buffalo to, or connect the Great Lakes to the Hudson River. And almost within a decade of when they opened the Erie Canal, the railroad came along and completely made it obsolete.
It's like MySpace.
It was just like, what was the one before MySpace?
Friendster.
Friendster, right. It's the Friendster.
The Friendster canals.
And interestingly, one of the most, I wouldn't call it famous because no one really is paying attention to Rochester, New York. I'm afraid to say. Sorry, Rochester.
It's hurtful.
And in fact, Rochester—
If you're studying the opioid epidemic, maybe.
Rochester is named after an ancestor of mine, Nathaniel Rochester.
No.
Yeah.
Who married Jane Eyre?
No. No, that was a different Rochester.
Is it related? Rochester and Roderick etymologically related at all?
No. They're not. No, the Rodericks married into the Rochesters, but the Rochesters are an old American family and the Rodericks are a new one.
I see. The Rochesters, the old money.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the old family.
They didn't, they didn't actually have money?
The money didn't percolate down.
They named
down.
A town after a poor, poor family? Or did they win a contest or something?
No, they were doing okay, but I don't think of the Rochesters as having money because they didn't give me any money.
I see. If nobody gives you money, they can't be rich.
That's right.
That's right. You probably think I'm incredibly poor then.
Well, you've yet to give me a damn thing. You just won $50 on your internet thing and you're like, how do I spend this $50? And I said, give it to me. And you acted like I had said nothing.
No, I thought it was a good. I thought it was a good little witticism. I could have rung my bell if I had one.
But Rochester has an abandoned subway system.
Wait, the whole system?
The whole system, and some of it, or a large kind of the main line, was built in the remnant of the Erie Canal as it flowed through Rochester. So they took the old path under the city and they turned it into a subway, and then the subway itself. They turned it into a subway when Rochester was a burgeoning American manufacturing city. Mm-hmm. And then as Rochester fell into decline, they also closed the subway.
And put the canal back.
They did not put the canal back.
That's what they should do. They should just flood it.
Well, the canal system, the Erie Canal is always being restored. And in the United Kingdom, their canal system also is having a resurgence. People are advocating kind of restoring disused parts of it, and it's really a kind of a great little feature of the country.
I'm sure it's fantastic, but is it really efficient for goods and services anymore?
No, right? No, but it's neat to have a little canal boat, and it's sort of Amsterdam-y.
There's so many locks is what I've noticed. Like what just walking along that canal in Manchester, I was like, I can't imagine trying to go through here on any kind of boat or barge. It would, there was a lock every, 500 feet.
There are these wonderful places along that system where a railroad will be going in a trench, there will be another railroad crossing it over that in a bridge. And then above that will be the canal in a viaduct.
the canal's overhead.
The canal is over two railroad tracks. It's great. But during the Beeching plan, they took so many railroads out of the United Kingdom and left all these rail right-of-ways. Beautiful viaducts and tunnels and paths cutting through the countryside and railway stations, all abandoned. And in recent years, they've turned a lot of those into bike paths.
That's happened here with like streetcar
right.
lines. A lot of American cities have gotten great bike trails and jogging trails out of their
Well, and old railroads too have turned into bike paths, but people are trying to get some of those rail lines restored in the UK. But there's the whole train spotting culture is really into old railway stations.
And very British, right? I mean, for every American train spotters, there are 20,000 British people in anoraks out looking at a platform.
There it goes.
And you know why? Thomas the Tank Engine. They all were raised on talking trains with different personalities. And of course, if you believe that every train has a story and a biography,
right,
you're going to go stand by the tracks. And even if they don't have googly eyes, you're going to be like, ah, there's the 417.
Well, as we know, all British people are overgrown children also.
They are.
So they're just like...
They've got those rosy cheeks. They want people to bring them cookies in the middle of the afternoon with tea.
That's right. They're breast fetishists.
They're like Benny Hill's bosomy women because they were all breastfed till they were like nine.
But one of the most famous sort of abandoned railroads... or abandoned railroad histories, is the story of the U-Bahn in Berlin.
Oh, now we're talking.
And I know that you know some things about this. So Berlin had a vibrant subway system. And then
predated the wall, right?
Right, but it was one of the early subways, actually. Berlin was interconnected.
There's U2 songs about it. Are there U2 songs about the Rochester subway? Probably not.
No, although there might be songs by, like, Duke Jupiter about the Rochester subway system. To people in upstate New York, that Duke Jupiter reference is just for you.
Seven people just went through the roof.
Seven 52-year-olds were like, what? But in the early 1960s, when the East German government cracked down on migration through Berlin and built the Berlin Wall.
They had lost like 20% of the population because people would just be like, wait, it's better over there.
I'm just going to walk over there and there will be shopping.
I can literally take the subway and not be in a like communist totalitarian society.
So they built this wall down the middle of the city that people might have heard of. Even futurelings might have heard of this Berlin Wall.
What did they call this Berlin Wall?
They called it the Berlin Wall. The East Germans called it the anti-imperialist protection wall or something.
Is that true?
There's
the AIPW.
It was not called the Berlin Wall.
Well, they had to have a different name because theirs had no graffiti. They had a much cleaner wall than we did.
They did. If you graffitied a wall in Berlin, let me tell you what, mister. You met Alexander Solzhenitsyn is what happened.
The rest of us pronounce it Solzhenitsyn, but you say Solzhenitsyn.
It's Solzhenitsyn.
That's actually a correct L. You're going to confuse everyone. So when they built the wall, what happened to the subway?
Well, so certain parts of the U-Bahn actually were contained within either side of Berlin, and so those train lines could continue to operate. But there were lots of crossing points and lots of train lines that went from one side to the other that were actually walled up with bricks. There were a few lines which remained open, which went from the western side to the eastern side and then back to the west. And so there were subway stops in East Germany that the train went past on its way from one West German stop to the other.
Because East Germans were not allowed to go down and use that platform, so it was effectively closed.
Right, it was closed. I think there were East German guards standing there giving you the hairy eyeball as you went through, because the trains had to slow as they went through East Germany, too. The tracks weren't maintained to the same standard. Right. So your subway train would slow to 20 miles an hour.
To an eerie pace as you go through this dimly lit Twilight Zone station.
Yeah, where guys in fur hats just like stared at you. Impassively, and also impassively.
Probably both, if the doors don't open.
There was a stop where you could get off in East Germany as a West German. And I think you wrote a little bit about this in one of your weird books for children, didn't you? Or in one of your many columns that appear next to Marilyn Vos Savant.
I like when you're doing your little late night show host thing where it's like, it says here, Ken... you have a story about the U-Bahn.
No, I've read a lot of your written work because it appears, in dentist's offices and stuff where I'm often waiting
I did a weekly column for a long time for a Condé Nast travel magazine about weird spots on the Earth's surface.
Yeah, and, I used to see that all the time. And
yeah, so this Friedrichstrasse station was like one of the right now it's the busiest station in Berlin. You know, in the unified era. During World War II, it was where all the Kindertransport kids left for England, fleeing the Holocaust. In one of the Bourne movies, it's where Jason Bourne jumps down from a train station onto a barge.
Right.
It's like the reverse of your canal over the train tracks thing. But during the Cold War, it got very interesting because that was right on the border. It was a big checkpoint.
Sure, that river was the border.
Yeah, and when they put up the wall, they had to divide that station in two. And so many of the S-Bahn trains and all of the U-Bahn trains through Friedrichstrasse were only for West Berliners.
So the S-Bahn was the trains, those were the trains that went out to the suburbs.
Yeah.
And the U-Bahn were the trains that were, that went within the city.
Yeah, it's effectively the subway. And so you could actually cross an international border by changing floors. You know, you'd go down a flight of stairs in East Germany and you'd be directly below where you were, but now you'd be in West Germany because you know, that would be on the other side of the checkpoint. So it's probably the only place on Earth where a national border actually went on the Z-axis, you know, between up and down instead of north and south.
Going down to West Germany or up to East.
Exactly.
I had the eerie experience. In 1989, before the wall came down, I went to East Berlin by accident. I went there on purpose.
By accident. I was misled by some of my fellow travelers. I was told I would have a job and apartment waiting. You didn't defect.
I didn't, no. I mean, I traveled to East Berlin officially through checkpoints and with passports and looking through little slots and nice. and walking through a maze.
Spy who came in from the cold stuff.
But the first time I went, I was on a train going through West Berlin and I just was dozing, smoking cigarettes and I don't know what, playing with my pocket knife.
Didn't have a phone yet, so you were thinking about a girl and whittling.
That's right. Doop-de-doo-de-doo. And I looked down and the train was going across a river and I knew that was maybe like not the best deal.
Like a different socioeconomic system might await you on the other side of the
Well, and as it went across the river, then it went across a lot of different barbed wires. And I said, this can't be good. And so as the train pulled into the next station, I got off and I was very in East Berlin. Everyone was in a polyester suit that was the color of like gray, like some kind of gray-green.
Honecker gray.
And I stood out like a sore thumb, right? I had long hair and was wearing some kind of ski jacket and had playing with a pocket knife.
You looked like a British train spotter.
I really, really did. It wasn't an anorak though. It was like one of those, it was a 80s ski jacket. So
nice.
It had like lightning bolts on it. And
was it puffy? How much puffier were you than the average East German?
I had a lot more puff.
They couldn't afford down. They had to eat all their feathers during the
They did have puffy jackets, but they were, again, the color of like coffee that had been out in the rain for a year.
Only sad colors allowed.
So I talked to someone. I went up to someone and said, hey, I'm not in West Berlin, am I? And they were like, you are not. You need to go down these stairs, go over to the other side and get on the train going the opposite way. And I did. No one molested me. I stood there for a long time because those trains don't come that often.
If you tried to leave the station, probably that's when you would have wound up in trouble.
I would have had to have gone through some kind of check and then that would have been I don't mean a Czech person.
It was a German person.
It was a German person.
Who looked like a Czech.
But they would have given me the business. I talked to someone at that point who said I could have gone all the way to Poland if I had just had the right...
Just had the right anorak?
If I just had the right amount of money, if I'd been able to pay.
If my ski jacket had been a little more depressing, I could have just got off in Krakow.
But the train came in and I got back on it and went back across and no one ever checked my ticket or asked me for any money. It was just like, oh, okay. Could I have kept going? Could I have gone to Poland? Could I right now be married to a Russian woman and living in St. Petersburg, having forgotten English entirely?
I came very close to your dream. My wife actually lived in East Berlin in the
90s.
Right. It was right after the wall came down because her dad was with the Foreign Service. I think at the time he was the commercial attaché to East Germany and probably Germany.
So there was still an East Germany at the time.
I think it was probably reunified. What's that, 89?
Yeah, it happened the next year in 1990. It took them a while, but as soon as the wall came down, it came down with a quickness.
She was probably there at unification then.
Yeah.
And the place where they had them live was East Germany. It was in East Germany. It was on East Berlin. And it had formerly been a Stasi listening post.
Oh.
So every room in their house had like 8 phone jacks, which was amazingly convenient.
That's so amazing.
Until you had a mental image of like what was going on in your living room or your guest room.
Right, guys in leather trench coats. 5 years
previous. Exactly.
So I went to, the first time I visited East Berlin, it was, you know, 6 months, I guess, before the wall came down. It was like in May or June of 89.
Hold on. Are you taking credit?
No,
I had nothing to do with it. As a result.
No, they were not impressed by me. I went over and changed money and had this astonishing number of East German Deutschmarks that I struggled to spend. And I went to the nicest restaurant in East Berlin with a couple of like American friends. And we had a lavish and disgusting meal and were drunk.
You ordered every bottle of everything.
And were loud and just the worst kind of American. I mean, we weren't wearing college sweatshirts that said like Dartmouth, so we weren't the worst kind of Americans. I mean, we at least looked like.
So you didn't help the wall come down. You probably kept it up for a few months.
Yeah.
Like the wall would have come down a few months earlier if you guys had just been a little better behaved at dinner.
It was kind of crazy that you could go over there and spend a day. I mean, you couldn't spend the night, but we spent a day and struggled to spend the amount of Deutschmarks that we were forced to change. But then I was in Florence and picked up the International Herald Tribune, and it said crazy things going on in Berlin. And it was November 9th or something like that. And there was no reason for me to be in Florence. I had already exhausted all of the people that might have hosted me, and they were
your travel is based not on tourist attractions but who has a couch.
Yeah, they were well ready for me to be gone. And so I jumped on a train and showed up in Berlin, you know, a day and a half later. And
are you in the videos, like with a hammer?
I look for myself in every photograph. I mean, I had really long hair and I had a hammer and I pounded on the wall and I sat on top of it and people took my picture. There were lots of photographers there, but I've never found myself in all of those books and reports. I'm just like, come on, one picture is all I ask. Just let my experience be documented by one notable.
I love this idea of you as some kind of Forrest Gump character popping up at every important juncture of history.
Yeah, I like it too, but it's unfortunately like, as far as the world is concerned, I'm invisible. I do pop up everywhere, but I'm not even sure. Am I real?
Maybe you'll, if this holds, maybe you'll get to see Track 61 someday.
Is this Garfield without Garfield? Are you just John, like talking pathetically to himself?
Everyone else who listens to this podcast just hears me talking. Like I have created you.
But when Berlin was first unified, there were all those ghost stations, which actually have a name in German.
Geisterbahnhof,
ghost train
literally
station.
Ghost stations, yeah.
They were perfectly preserved in their they were preserved in their state in 1961, what they had been, with advertisements on the walls.
Oh, nice.
And little, you know, direction signs and old phones and stuff in the offices. And so the German transit authorities wanted to reopen these stations, but they didn't quite have the sentimentality for Eastern Europe that we do now. And so they didn't keep any of the old ads. They didn't preserve any of the stations in their Geisterbahnhof.
In their haunted state.
Their Scheisse-Bahnhof state. They could have, you know, put up a plexiglass over the old
signs. Like what if today you walked through and it's just all these 60s era ads for Knorr soups or whatever.
People would love it, but, and I like you pronounce it Knorr. But no,
I always put Knorr on my Knackwurst.
They cleaned it all up, and now those stations, some of them are some of the busiest stations in Berlin, but others that had been very important stations like Potsdamer or Potsdam, I guess, Potsdam Platz.
I think that's right.
Which was a main station during the divided years, became kind of a
Geister town?
Yeah, just not a useful station anymore. There were
because
others.
There used to be federal stuff there that's not there anymore, right. Or something.
And eventually that became a ghost station, closed because there wasn't any use for it anymore.
The last victim of the Cold War.
Potsdam Platz.
And that concludes track 61. Entry 1324.EZ0808, certificate number 33725, in the omnibus. Listeners, we speak to you from a time when there is an epidemic of social media. We hope these will all become Geisternetwerken for you. But in our day, they are busy with the metaphorical trains of memes and quips and
abandoned rail cars,
cat videos whizzing by,
canals that have been filled in and reopened.
John and I are extremely supportive of social media. We love it and think it's been a net good for humanity.
I'll say.
And as a result, we are very active at Omnibus Project on every platform you can think of, even the Geister Platformen.
Geister Platformen.
Go look up at Omnibus Project on Friendster. See what you find.
Shucky darn and slopthechickens.org.
And is that the very first social media network? It was for farmers. It's like Farmer, like Tinder.
Oh, awful, like Grindr.
That's right. Wait, Tinder has an E, huh?
I don't know. Grindr doesn't.
Grindr does not.
Not that have I would know.
We seem very convinced that Grindr does not have an E. Yeah, Tinder does have an E. That's how behind the scenes of internet dating we are.
Yeah.
John is at John Roderick on Tinder and Grindr, mm-hmm. and Twitter and Instagram.
Come find me.
I'm at Ken Jennings only on Twitter and Grindr, of course. We also maintained an electronic mail account, if you know what that is, at omnibusproject@howstuffworks.com. If you wanted to send us physical corporeal items, not Geister Artefakten.
No.
But actual
things.
That you could touch or rub or not eat, we've said.
No, but look at snowflakes through.
Sure. If you want to send us some kind of microscope camera or a period map of the Berlin U-Bahn.
Just go down to the time post and send it through what we know to be true, a wormhole.
Send it through a fourth dimensional wormhole to Omnibus Project, P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. If you're interested in the philosophical goals of the omnibus to such a degree that you want to commune with other like-minded souls, whether they're tentacled, silicon-based, metaphorical thought forms that have somehow found a way to access this, they all congregate at the Futurelings group on Facebook.
Be sure, if you're joining the Futurelings group, to answer the two test questions if they appear. If you are on an Android device, maybe they don't appear, in which case... tough luck.
At the time of this recording, one of the questions asks for the shape of time, which is not something we have mentioned in a while, I think.
No, we haven't. And in fact, there are a lot of different ideas about what shape time is.
Time is a stellar dendritic snowflake.
Hmm.
Perhaps.
Perhaps.
I have no idea.
It is a Dali-esque melting clock on top of a fractal, like, trip-out poster from a college dorm.
Turn on the black light and the universe gets crazy.
Listeners, from our vantage point, inside an abandoned FDR-era rail car parked on track 61 under the Chinese-owned Waldorf Astoria Hotel.
That is where we record the show. I think it's time that everyone should know.
With a diesel locomotive idling, constantly filtering.
Ready to go, should something happen.
Filtering diesel smoke up the elevator shaft into your $8,000 a night room. We have no idea how long our civilization survives. We hope or survived, from your standpoint.
Yeah, tense is difficult.
We hope and pray, or we hoped and prayed, that the catastrophe that we fear, that you know, may never come. It's hilarious how much you must laugh every episode.
At our naivete.
Because you know, it's to you, it is the December 7th, 1941. It is the 1492 when your Columbus sailed the... chlorine ocean yellow.
What if it's not hilarious then? What if it's sad? What if it's poignant that we always seem so that we always seem so lively, but they know it was all doomed.
They miss us. They're all wearing red baseball hats that say "Make the Earth Great Again."
By listening
to the Omnibus Podcast. If the work comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.